Welcome back to the Skits and Giggles podcast. I am Pascal, chief instigator of this show and your host. I'm joined by my co-host and our resident engineer, the yin to my yang, the reach to my stack, Bryson. How's it going today, buddy?
Going great, Pascal. How you doing?
I'm good, man. Today, we are joined by the man behind Vane Bicycles, Robert Janssen. Robert, welcome to the Skits and Giggles podcast. How's it going today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for doing this in English. It really means a lot to us. Before we get to our conversation, let's briefly do our spiel with the social and where you guys can find more information about the Skits and Giggles podcast. We're currently most active on our Instagram, where you can skid right into our DMs and follow along at Skits and Giggles. And you can find our website with all the relevant links and info under the URL skitsandgiggles.com. Also, if you guys like what we're doing and want to know what's up, just give us a follow on Spotify. Hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to great podcasts. Finally, sharing our episodes on our socials or a heartfelt five-star rating on your favorite platform goes a long way in helping us reach more people like you. Right on. Let's get back to Robert. Robert, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into mountain bikes, and what your riding looks like today?
Yeah, sure. I come really, really late to the mountain bike scene, actually. I started mountain biking in a serious way about 2014 in the summer. That was, bought my first fully mountain bike. It was a Kona Process 134. And that's where I started.
Very nice. A cool bike. And yeah, I think we've had quite a few guests that had their first experiences and found their love for riding on a Kona. So everything was not so great with this mountain bike, and at some stage you thought you needed to have your own mountain bikes and start your own bike company. And tell us a little bit about the bike that made you start Vane Bicycles.
I was riding this Kona a long time, and I changed all the parts, almost everything except the frame. So at the end, what I want to say, I'm still riding this bike today, so it's not crap or something else. But I brought it quite to the edge, and at some point my riding style changed a little bit into more in hike and bike. So I carry up the bike on the shoulder up to a mountain or crossing a pass, and riding down on the other side of the mountain. And of course, this Kona is not a carbon bike. It is about 16 kilogram weight. And myself, I'm only 60 kilogram person, so it's about a quarter of my own weight to carry up the mountain. And I thought it's too heavy. And I start searching for a new bike, a light one, a flexible one, a slack head angle for riding down the mountain, and but still capable to ride uphill. That was really important. And it should have a kind of aesthetic aspects. It should have been well designed, integrated cables, routes, everything, and a clean look at the end. And to find this bike, I struggled about 2 years. And then I decided to build one by myself.
And did you have any experience with building bikes, or you know, were you just starting from scratch? I decided I'm going to build my bike and off I go.
No, I just thought it could not that be complicated. No, I started really from the scratch and had no experience with building a bicycle. I brought some experience for material specifications. I know how to weld materials, steel and aluminium. So I bought also a new welding machine, and every tools I had to use to build a bicycle, I just brought it together. and start building bikes.
But now, Vane Bicycles, it's now out in the open. It's been out in the open for a couple of months now, I believe. So what is the goal, or what is your vision with Vane Bicycles? What kind of problem are you looking to solve?
I think it was some times back, a few years ago, I came to the idea that I'm not the only one searching for a bike that fits and a lightweight version for riding down a mountain with a nice, beautiful frame. So I start thinking about other people's, for example, tall people or short people with long arms or short legs. And I think they had much more struggle than me to find a perfect bike for them. So why don't help them?
What talked to me from the beginning, of course, was the very clean design of your frames, which, you know, when I saw the first photos, I was very impressed. It was like looked very sleek, very clean, very well designed. And of course, that's only possible because you're using kind of novel production techniques with 3D printing. Can you talk a little bit about that? How did you come to deciding that, you know, you want to go the 3D printing route?
Yeah, there was about three major reasons for the decision to take or to use the 3D printing technology. It's about this integrated cable routing. That's quite possible in designing that and on the CAD model and getting it out of the printer. And there are still a little bit complicated with the internals of the frame, but at the end, the outside view is quite beautiful. I think the second reason was to move those stress points from welded frames, for example, out of these corners to another position. For example, here I use the adhesive bonding at another point, and I could de-stress the entire frame junction.
Okay, so yeah, that makes sense, right? So because, of course, when you use aluminium and welding, and then like all the stress is on the joints or on the, you know, where the tubes come together, and with 3D printing, you can create a more efficient structure in terms of deflecting the different forces.
Exactly, yeah. And the third reason was because of the sizing geometry matrix that I have developed. There are so many different frame sizes, with every frame has a own angles in every corner, and it creates a lot of different articles to build a locked frame to that. So the 3D printing was also offering the freedom to design those parts.
Makes a lot of sense. The of course, there's a couple of other brands out in the market today that are using similar techniques. Have you exchanged ideas with any of those brands, or, you know, had conversations, or have you done everything on your own?
In the beginning, I couldn't say that I have exchanged any ideas. Of course, I have seen other manufacturers using 3D printing technologies, and I was in contact with others too, but we haven't discussed about the problems or solutions yet.
Why did you decide on a lug construction instead of perhaps making a full top tube 3D printed, or like a major half section of the front triangle, or two halves? It seems that lug construction is traditionally made from steel lugs, and then you braze steel tubes to them. So you have kind of the same materials there, and you know, like on old racing bikes, you know. So what's the difference between making a really big 3D print and just the lug itself?
I think the major topic is to make it cost efficient. of course, you can print an entire bike in a 3D printer and put it together after that, but a 3D printing is time consuming, and that's what it makes it really expensive.
I see. And so the tubes that you use to connect the aluminium lugs are made of which material?
They're made of stainless steel. So I use industrial standard stainless steel, high precision tubes. And instead of the famous Columbus or Reynolds tubing, because I have a wider choice of sizes, so I can really choose from a tenth of millimeters in the wall thickness and set every calculation just what I get on the market.
I see. Okay. So you also size up the tubes based on the size of the frame as well?
The dimension of the tube itself, not directly, it's just about the length then to connect those lugs together.
And do you need to put the lugs through any post-treatment after they're 3D printed? Is there a sanding procedure or something like this before you bond them with the stainless steel?
I'm working with the 3D printing company, which is heat treating the 3D printed part after the taking it out of the printer. And this makes all these characteristics much better of the part itself.
Okay, so you have a certain amount of precision from them, and you're able to basically take that product and with very minimal preparation, do your fitting and bonding to make the complete frame.
I have to prepare this parts or the connection surfaces just before the bonding itself. That's a part of the procedure in the production of the frame building itself then. But from the company, we also skipped some...
How about this? Robert, can you take us through the procedure to take all the raw materials and set them up into a form of a bicycle frame? Like I've seen them do it with welding, and I've done my own brazed bicycle, but I haven't seen a stainless steel and aluminium 3D printed lug construction. So maybe just briefly walk us through the steps on how to do that.
There are some preparations to do on the 3D printed parts. The surfaces for the boundary have to be cleaned, grinded and cleaned again just for preparation for the adhesive. The same with the tubing. They need to be cut and bent and also grinded, cleaned and grinded again to have this good surface for the adhesive to give a strength boundary at the end. And after the adhesive is applied, I do some heat treatment, but the low temperature heat treatment to the entire frame, just to harden out the adhesive itself.
And what temperature are we talking about? Like 60 degrees Celsius?
It's about 65 degrees.
Okay.
So for 2 hours, 65 degrees.
I see. So just to accelerate the curing of the adhesive. So once the adhesive is set and you have your frame in the jig, you could basically take it out and build a bike, or just doing a minor thread chasing and then head tube reaming just to get surfaces flat, or what's the next step?
It's basically just take the frame out of the holding system and then grinding all this spilled glue out of the frame. And after that, it's just cleaning it, bringing it to the paint shop. And then I will receive it back and doing all this bike components related work, like thread cutting in the bottom bracket and everything.
Right on. So you're doing a lot of the assembly, or you're doing all of the assembly yourself at your own premises. And you, you're, also, not only assembling it in Switzerland, you're also having these 3D lugs printed in Switzerland, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Also, the stainless steel tubing is coming from a Switzerland producer?
Yes, I have a supplier here in Switzerland, but they will not produce it here anymore. I think there's no steel production company in Switzerland based.
Okay, that's an interesting topic, right? Because we've had you know, quite a few conversations where this sustainability and transparency issue has been very, very important. And you know, I think I talk for Bryson and myself, and we say that this is something that is very important to us, or increasingly so. Is this also something you've thought about when you created your company?
Yeah, that's definitely a point. I try to avoid high energy consuming manufacturing procedures. Therefore, I don't use aluminium frames or tubing and welding it, because they need a heat treatment after that. And this is also high energy consumption. And of course, a 3D printing is not the best example for low energy consumption procedures, but it's kind of compromising everything. So when we talk about sustainability, you have to focus at each single point and check what can you do on this one and what can you make it better. For example, steel tubes aren't made anymore in Switzerland, so you have a long supply chain, and you cannot decide to other tubes because there are no options.
But do you work with your supplier to make sure that, you know, it's not something from Far East in a very, you know, let's say, in air quotes, dirty factory with the most terrible human rights track record and all that sort of stuff. So do you know, so you kind of know from where your supplier is getting the material for you? So do you kind of know that your supplier is working with like credible suppliers himself?
Yeah, it's quite difficult from a small company's position to ask in a supply chain or a supplier if they can do anything for sustainability on your own company. So I don't have any possibilities to influence on them. For example, on the steel tubes, I ask them for about 100 meter of tubes, and that for them it's kind of nothing.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's I think it's just an interesting notion, right? So because if we ask, let's say, our economy to change towards a more sustainable and more transparent way of working, then we need to be more demanding when it comes to these things. And you know, we have an example. We had a conversation with Phil Law from Pembury, and then he's obviously using aluminium, and of course there's nothing in the world that will make aluminium a nicer material to get out of the ground and more efficient when it comes to energy consumption. But you know, what he's trying to do is just making sure that wherever he gets his aluminium from is is a reputable producer, and he knows it's from this certain producer in Russia in this case, or wherever else it is. So that's, I think, something that's getting quite important.
I think maybe I'll just throw it out there. There are sellers for different metals that will be able to tell you, give you like an origin paper, basically. It's like a traceability that says, we got it from this factory in whatever, China, Taiwan, or wherever around the world. And it will have like a stamp, and it's for like a lot of material that came in. And in some cases, they're able to trace, okay, the pipe that we gave you came from either this lot or this lot, and these are the two factories that we bought it from, or this is the factory we bought it from, and it has two batch pieces of paper that says, you know, with their stamp and their signature, and we get it when it arrives here, and then it's a sort of traceability, maybe not exactly, but can give you a little bit better picture in case you wanted to inquire.
Or some reassurance.
Yeah, of course, there are some official declarations for companies to state. For example, this AOHS declaration, the conformity that they don't use any toxic materials or lubrications in that company. And the REACH conformity is also one part of it. And all the suppliers are fulfilling that at the moment. So, but that's those minimum requirements that we can ask for as a small company or brand or whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's good. You know, something you should also be pushing for, even as a small company. And I like what you're doing. Of course, I mean, the notion of, you know, using more efficient production techniques like 3D printing is, of course, already a first step in the right direction, right? Because, yes, it's not energy efficient, but it's very efficient with the material because, you know, you basically have the printer and the powder and, you know, whatever powder you're not using, you can use it for something else. There's not much left over. so that's you know, already a good step. One thing, so what, right now, what does your model list look like? So right now you only have one hardtail. Is there anything else planned?
I got a couple of ideas and also different techniques to realize that ideas. But what I learned the last 3 years in developing one bike is do it one by one. And now I'm finishing this mountain bike, hardtail mountain bike. A big idea I want to follow up in the near future is a fully mountain bike. But maybe I have to prioritize the gravel bike first.
For sure.
The market demands.
That's right, the market demands. And then when you start building up a company, you have to listen to the market a little bit and not doing your own stuff. Otherwise, you lost your money in a second.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know. You can't beat the market, so so it's you know, it's an interesting segment in Switzerland in particular. You know, I think I treated myself to a custom road bike 8 years ago, and if I had the foresight to know what cycling looks like in 2020 or, you know, even 2018 or whatever, then I wouldn't have gone for a full-on road bike. I would have gone some kind of an all-road or something bike, just because here in Switzerland, yes, the roads are fantastic and, you know, traffic is safe and all that. But, I mean, you have just so many more possibilities with, you know, forest roads and mountain service roads and all that sort of stuff. It's just... yeah, so of course, like the cross section between a mountain bike and a road bike, but you know, it doesn't need to tick all the boxes of a mountain bike, and it doesn't need to tick all the boxes of a road bike. So I think it's a very interesting segment at the minute. Although, of course, the cynical view is that now that they start putting flat handlebars on it, it's becoming mountain bikes from the 90s.
And in terms of vein cycling technology, your next models, will they also be using the 3D printed lug construction?
Yes, I will think so, because I try to apply this geometry matrix also on the gravel bike to give a rider the full choice what size he want to ride and what length, what height. Maybe in a different way, not in a 30 different sizes, maybe a little bit shorter, 20 or something. I was still working on that.
Okay, that's a very good transition and a segue to, I think, the other standout feature of Vane bicycles, and that's of course your geometry matrix and you know, the 30 different sizes that you offer for your mountain bike frame. Of course, Bryson and myself, we are a little bit of a geometry dorks when it comes to bikes, so this is something that we are very interested in. Can you talk us through what is the idea with your geometry matrix? What are the basic principles?
The idea is to have the rider as the fixed position or the fixed point on a bicycle system. When you see the bike and the rider as a system, and the sizes goes from very, very small bikes to quite big bikes to cover all these different people in the world. The focus on that is mainly on three measures on the body. It's the inner leg height, the arm length, and the shoulder height. And I use a simple calculation formulas that are existing since maybe 20, 30 years, 40 years or longer. So that's nothing new. But to use these formulas and put it into a matrix to cover all these people, or the most of them, I think it's about 98% of all people can choose a bike that fits quite well. That was one of those, unique ideas, yeah.
You know, it's great. And in terms of your production technique, it's of course... you know, opens up a lot of different combinations, but I think that's obvious. But what are the challenges of offering so many sizes? Before we get into more what the matrix is,
I think the challenging thing is that I cannot take anything on stock. So I produce on order. If anybody places an order, I just check out the CAD data, send it to the 3D printing company, and go get those parts after 10 days, for example, finished and ready to build up the frame. But it also promises that I can produce frame in 4 to 5 weeks completely with the paint job. And in this age, with the corona situation of supply chain from Asia, I think that's quite a good position in the market.
So we have a rider-centric geometry, and it's basically, as you said, it's a formula that's well-known and it's been used before. And it makes a lot of sense. Of course, you want the rider to be in an optimal position for power transfer to the pedals, for comfort, and for, agility to maneuver the bike. That would suggest that the geometry, or at least the seating position that's chosen, is designed for pedaling and not so much for maybe jumping maybe kind of a more progressive stance in the hardtail category, like these extra slack, super low bottom bracket style bicycles that we're seeing these days. Are we looking at a bike that's like kind of a trail cross country, or like, how would you describe, right now you have an E2, that's your size. How would you describe the style of riding that this bicycle is designed for?
It's kind of cross country style bike, but it has capabilities to ride single trails, really steep single trails. And, this makes really fun, I think. So I went to the mountains Saturday, 2 weeks before, and the weather was quite good still. And the steep single tracks makes really fun on it.
Okay, so you still have a quite a bit of ability to tackle extreme terrain, but while still having a pedal ability, a platform, a factor that allows you to stay in a good pedaling stance, let's say. I see. So a 30 size matrix is not seen so common in the industry, and for a good reason. It'd probably be really difficult for a lot of manufacturers to do so, at least the bigger ones. How are you able to manage deciding on 30 different sizes? So you have three reaches, is that correct?
I have 10 frame heights. With each of them has a three reach sizes. Yeah. And I think with the, because I'm a small, very, very, very small company, I got this flexibility to produce every frame on demand. And not like the big manufacturers, the pre-ordering frames for a complete season or complete production batch. And so I got this flexibility to create 30 different sizes.
Okay. And then how do they differ? So you say you got three different reaches and 10 different heights, but how do you decide between, for which arm length and which body height is which combination is the right one? Is that just a simple extrapolation? So kind of scaling from a base measurement or preference, or have you done any testing?
I've done testings on two different sizes, and all other sizes are kind of theoretic calculations. But those calculations are based on common formulas, and for those entire spectrum of those sizes, I've used the statistics from the body measurements, and I just transferred that into a matrix. What I did additionally to this spectrum of sizes, I put amount of a correction on a personal feeling. So after these testings, I corrected those formulas a little bit, and I also put a little bit on the market and feedback into this formula. So when you have a precise eye, you can see that the biggest frames are not in stepping that far with the reach, so they have a shorter reach extension on the three different reach sizes than per height. On the same on the smaller frames, I did some modification in the formula.
Okay. And were you kind of benchmarking your sizes against anything else that was out in the market, or and what kind of bikes?
Sure, that was one of the very first steps. Overall, I checked about 20, 30 manufacturers with their hardtail cross-country style bikes, check out that geometry, put it all into a table, data sheet, and think about it just to see it in the line.
But one thing you do that a lot of manufacturers don't do, especially on hardtails, is you have like a size-specific chainstays. Well, maybe not size-specific, but you have different lengths of chainstay. How did that work out?
It's because I see the rider as the fixed point on a bike, and as bigger the rider is go, or as bigger as the rider is, the position of the back wheel will also move a little bit, and the angle of the seat tube is changing too. So that requires a different sizing on the chainstay and also the rear triangle.
I guess one nice characteristic is on the smaller sizes, it's catered towards a 27.5-inch wheel. And in the larger sizes, you go to a 29. And I did a little configurator for myself, which I found on your website. And I came to the end where it says I'm either a C3 or a D3. And so when I looked further into the geometry to see which one I would prefer, it came down to this wheel size. So the C3 is the largest size that has a 27.5 wheel, and then a D3 would have a 29. And I guess, for someone like me, I could be in this person who said, no, I love 27.5 wheels. I love their agility, or maybe I favor them for my standover and nothing else. Or I could be the guy who says, yeah, it's all about the rollover. I want the 29. I'm all about that 29 style, and that's the go-to for me. So I'm going to size up to a D3. It's going to give me more stability, and that's just how I feel about it. So I'm one of those people who fall in there, who are a little bit maybe lucky to choose.
It's maybe luck for you, but it was a really hard decision for me, because I designed the bike as a 29-inch cross-country wheeling bike. And but when you consider small people on a 29-inch wheel bike, then you must do something.
Oh, for sure. And also, of course, at this juncture of the bike industry, we now start using mixed wheel sizes. And of course, Bryson, he's already alluded to it with being right between the 29er and the 27.5 sizes on the hardtail. That's why, in the real world, he's currently riding a mullet bike with a 27.5 in the rear and a 29 in the front. I mean, it's funny, because I was just on the weekend, I was at the Swiss Enduro Championships, and there's actually quite a number now of people that are running mullet sizes on trail bikes, race bikes, even some cross country bikes. You start seeing it, and it just gives more people the option to find the right size for them and the right balance of the bike. And I think, but for a producer, it's obviously even more difficult to get the right geometry and the right, feel of the bike that, then the riders will like.
Yeah. In fact, when you put a 27.5 wheel in a bag on a 29-inch bike, then you will change the entire geometry. So you've got a slacker head tube angle, a slacker seat tube angle. The bottom bracket lowers down a little bit, and I think that changes the entire feeling of the bike. And some do that on purpose, but I think manufacturers are not calculating to that.
But of course, you said 30 sizes, and that you basically manufacture to order. Then, of course, the follow-on question to that is, what is stopping you from going full custom? Are you going to also offer people to look at your sizing geometry chart and say, well, for example, I used the size selector, and I would fall on a G1. I looked at the geometry for a G1, and then I saw I go for 53 reach. And that's kind of like three to four centimeters short to what I normally ride, what kind of where I've settled in terms of my preference. I've gone much longer than that. I've gone much shorter than that, but kind of the 480 neighborhood with a 5 centimeter or 50 millimeter stem is kind of my happy place. Of course, and I saw bottom bracket drop, and it's like a bit lower would probably be nice, and a chainstay probably a bit longer would be nice. So are you thinking of offering like the full custom experience if clients request that?
Yeah, that's the keyword you said. It's more the preferences of the customer. If you want to have a full custom bike, then it requires more than three dimensions of the body. Then you need those adjustment bike where you can move any part of the bike to just fit to your body. And for that, I'm totally not prepared. But I can come together to the customer with preferences to check with what's possible to change on the drawings or on the bike itself.
But let's say if I come to you with my preferred measurements of what I would like, then would you say like, oh, that's, I mean, it's not like crazy adjustments. Let's say, a couple of millimeters here, maybe a degree or two there. Is that completely overthrowing your approach, or is that something you can accommodate, that you can work with?
I think if it's only a couple of millimeters, then it depends on the position of the frame where the millimeters have to be removed or added. I think that's no point of discussion. We can talk about that. No problem.
Would be a fun experiment.
But it's obviously one question with geometry. If we look at the last few years, the mountain bike geometry has kind of finally left the dark ages of road bike geometry where it came from in the 80s and 90s. It's gone a bit. Some say it's gone a bit too far. In terms of the length and the slackness and how low it is and all that sort of stuff. What is your view on the mountain bike geometry of the future? Where do you think it will settle?
I think they will find a sweet spot somewhere, because at the moment it's like pushing boundaries. The bike park's getting faster, the track's getting faster, so you need a faster bike, you had a slacker head angle. Of course, such bikes you cannot use anymore on steep and narrow single tracks. But there are other type of bikes and geometries for that. So I think the trend is still ongoing. Faster bikes, racing machines, and somewhere maybe in 5 or in 10 years it will slow down a little bit with the changes. But I'm not sure if they will move back. Maybe there's some revival of old geometries, but I don't think they will move back then.
Robert, what's the story behind vein cycling technology? Why did you choose vein as a word? I mean, I'm imagining a villain from Batman, but obviously we're talking bicycles here.
There's not a big story behind that. It's more a little bit awkward. It was my nickname in the mid of 2000s. So everybody was calling me Wayne, and I answered Wayne Interest, Wayne Interessiert, Wayne.
Ah. Nice. German wordplay. I love it.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it.
So it was a vein bicycle for kind of a beginner, an expert. Where does it fall for the consumer?
I think it's more for the advanced people. They have already done those experience on their first and the second bike, and now searching for a bike that fit more to the bodies and goes more into customized bikes. And so I think that's those people I'm asking to buy my bikes.
All right. And I noticed on the seat tube, top tube, seat stay junction, you have on there also embossed number one. Is it possible, like, if I were to sign up to get my name there instead? Can you 3D print my name on that lug instead?
Sure. On my bike, I have written Robert.
Oh, rad.
Depends on the amount of letters, but it's still possible.
So the story of Vein Cycles is a pretty interesting one. We have the standout 30 size matrix for bicycles in the lineup. There's this adhesive bonding technique to these 3D printed lugs out of aluminium, which look fantastic, and of course you can have them customized with your name on them. Has there been any industry interest, maybe a manufacturer or a design firm who has contacted you to maybe lease your design or your production technique?
Not directly in this way, but I thought 3 weeks ago I have submitted to the German Design Award in Frankfurt. So I submitted the project number one with all this geometry and the design itself. And those good news is that they have nominated me for that.
Oh, wow. So cool.
I'm really stoked about it.
Yeah. So which organization is this?
It's from the German Design Council. That's a kind of organization in Germany for most famous designs. And they got a couple of categories. And I submitted in the category excellent product design, bicycle and bikes.
Well, on that bombshell, on that closeout, we're getting towards the end of our time here. So we just want to wrap it up with our closeout class questions, if that's okay. I think we heard a little bit about that first bike that got you really stoked on riding. So can you talk us talk us through the color of your Kona Process 1-3-4?
The color is black and gold.
Fast. That's very fast.
And I changed almost everything. I changed those nuts on the chain ring into gold. I put some gold braided cable routings and
I
expressed myself.
Very cool.
Back into 17.
Very cool.
Fully pant.
All right. Well, then, you know, imagine you are Harry Schedini and you're a bike magician extraordinaire. You can make riding a bike more awesome for anyone by the stroke of a magic dropper post. What would you do?
I will found a company to build specific bikes for people with specific
so everyone
needs.
Can find the right size. Genius, groundbreaking
That's
idea.
Genius.
you should think about that.
Someone needs to follow that up.
So taking the Vane number one out for a ride. You mentioned a little bit of a hike a bike. So we're getting up to some rocky pass. Of course, in Switzerland, you're going to encounter a lot of hikers. But they're egging you on. They're telling you, hey, do a skid. Do a backflip. Okay, maybe not a backflip. Do a skid. How do you show off?
I like those Scandinavian flicks from the rally.
Enough said.
That's my skid, I think. But it makes most fun on road bikes.
And wet streets.
And wet streets. And high speed.
All right, full adrenaline, yeah.
All right. Well, Robert, thanks again for your time and for sitting down with us tonight. That was really, really cool. If listeners have any questions, you know, want to learn more about you and Vane Bicycles, where can they find you?
I'm present in the internet, yeah. The glory internet at vanebicycles.com. That's the homepage. There's also a possibility to submit to newsletter. And I try to post a lot of stuff on Instagram, but
yeah, we all
I
do.
Almost fail about that. So maybe every 1 or 2 weeks there's a new post.
Well, again, thank you very much. That was really cool. Bryson, thanks for your time too. And I hope to see you out on
Cheers,
the trails
boys.
One time soon.
Yeah.
Hope so too. All right. Thank you very much, dude.